Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 63. Socio-Poetic Travelogue, a conversation with Aisha Stevenson. Aisha fuses poetry and storytelling for a provocative and spiritual performance in her writing and on the stage. She received her MFA in writing from the California Institute of Arts in 2009. Also a social scientist, she holds an MA in applied sociology from the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She is most interested in looking at race, gender, and culture through a narrative, ethnographic, and feminist lens. Her interdisciplinary work has been published by Tessal Review, Soul Writers Anthology, Soul National University, A Gathering of the Tribes, and others. In 2011, she won the Silver Grace Notes Prize for book-length poetry and is the most recent winner of Imaginary Friend Press Full-Length Book Award for her book of poems, Black Hands of a Morning Calm, about her three-year expatriate experience in Seoul, South Korea. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Okay, welcome, Aisha Stevenson, to Between the Lines. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Monk. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for asking. It's great to have you on. I love to interview, we call it conversation because it's sort of more casual. And recently had a friend on named Tony Belize. I was talking to him about Nicaragua and Myanmar. So it's exciting to have you on because you have traveled as a writer to, you know, several places in the world that I don't know much about, so I'm eager to learn, you know, both about the places and to hear, you know, your impressions as a writer, and you're going to read some poems. And you were in Seoul, South Korea, and where in Vietnam?
Actually, I traveled all throughout Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Yes, including Saigon. So it was a very interesting experience just going all through the country. And I think the most interesting part of being in Vietnam for me was that it was just heartbreaking as an American to visit the war museum.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, I think where people get so caught up in the wars going on today that they forget, you know, the history that still lingers, you know, with the after effects of, like, I think you mentioned in some of your work, the Agent Orange and that kind of stuff that you know, still lingers on even though it's off of the news charts.
Yes, definitely. So actually the manuscript excerpt that I sent you, What Keeps Me Up at Night, one of the poems, Once Upon a Time in Vietnam, is pretty much how, you know, it's telling a story about how I just couldn't believe that I was having dinner with friends and two children came up to us and they were born with mutilations and it was just very difficult to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's got to be difficult. Well, I was planning to do the talk first, but hey, why don't we just jump in? Start off with that poem, the What Keeps You Up at Night? It's a bit of a longer poem, but that's fine. And then we'll start with Vietnam and then go to South Korea. How does that sound?
Okay, that sounds great.
All right.
So, Once Upon a Time in Vietnam is the title of this poem, and it's from What Keeps Me Up at Night.
Okay.
Ho Chi Minh commits suicide. In my bed, in the blackness of shut eyes, in a valley with no electricity, I am afraid. He walks out to a busy Saigon road, sits next to a monk, and they set themselves on fire. They burn quiet statements. My body jerks. The windows shake. The cold mountain air seeps under my sheets. Alone in my freeze, the top floor of this hostel is a windy penthouse. In the birth of dawn, my mother comes to mind in the beauty of the sunken weight of her morning smile. From the balcony, the sun rises, and I can see the French. The colorful tops of colonial villas spread, while wine country vineyards end in the white blurs of the lot peaks. The other girls have freckles. They are old mates. They share bed at night and don't see war. When they awake, hunger comes. We walk down to Lakai. The girls and I are giddy and giggling about riding mopeds through old Coho Hills and basking in the mist of elephant waterfalls. Licking our lips, we point to the fried rice. It's only a picture. Without walls, we sit in the street. This restaurant is open. We are a part of this city. Hundreds of mopeds sit by, toddlers holding on to rear handles, shiny black hair sweeping plump cheeks. The women driving only have eyes. In their face masks and pink helmets, they balance entire families in heavy bags of fruit. My tomatoes are so fresh and succulent, juicy strips of beef so tender and sweet. My rice is orange, glowing. The lime and salt surprise my tongue. I'm choking on a grain. I'm looking for saliva. One of the girls calls my name. I'm catching my breath to two children standing. Over our table, their palms are out, their arms are open. Her face is burned, her lip is gnawed. And he is missing fingers. How many? I don't know. The city stops talking. My head is up for long enough to meet old wounds, the holes in their eyes before I drop to the orange food for $1. A noisy silence consumes my body, like the heights of bloodshed and chaos on the battlefield. Le Petit Paris? Le Petit Paris? When I look up without a word, they are gone. We continue to eat, pay the bill, and leave $2 in some box with a red cross. The lot cowboys wander the streets of the Valley of Peace looking for America. It's back there in the orange where my head fell down at the table. My country's over there by the crosswalk where we see the little girl again, standing still. Now she carries a baby on her back, close to a woman whose feet, hands, and limbs are twisted. Up the hill to the penthouse, one of the girls asks, do you remember any more about the suicide? About men? No. Just that. I read his letter. I had it in my hand. It was the last of many that he wrote when he couldn't take the flies, the smell of burning children. He said, my obsession, its agency, my pores, they smell. I let the peasants pay. Too old, too sick am I for talk. Is this what it means to win, burning children, when you're too old, too sick, to have your talk matter? After 3 years of rolling thunder, I am out of names. My mother read the letter with me as we shivered from the balcony's wind. The city was crying for him. No villas, just broken bodies scattering like the heap of heavy tears. Oh, they're wailing, they're screaming. Lin Han Ko Tao, Lin Hao Ko Tao. What are they saying? My mother held my wrist. I looked at her and said, my soul. And so that's a piece from What Keeps Me Up at Night.
You read that beautifully, and yeah, it's quite a moving piece.
Thank you.
Yeah, just the sort of like the poet as journalist, conscience, you know, travel, the juxtaposition, you know, of describing some of the food and then seeing the children is, you know, really puts the listener, put me right in the scene, and it's quite stirring.
Well, you know, as a traveler and a writer, you're in that sort of situation. You're traveling, and it's not like taking a vacation. It's just, mm-hmm. You feel so into where you are, and so all of your senses just become so awakened by everything, you know?
Yeah, was that what was your main reason when you decided to go on these travels? Was there a particular reason to specifically write, or just to see the parts of the world, or both?
I think that's a great question. I mean, really what happened is that I graduated with an MFA in writing, mm-hmm. from the California Institute of Arts, and, you know, at that time in 2009, the economy was just in serious trouble. Mm-hmm. And I speak about that a lot in Black Hands of a Morning Calm, the poetry book that I have coming out towards the end of this year. And so for me, I didn't want to be another 30-something-year-old moving back home.
Right.
And I said to myself, what can I do? And so I started to look, you know, internationally, I think like many young professionals are doing nowadays. And I ended up getting a position at Seoul National University in Seoul, South Korea. And since I was there, I figured I really just want to see Asia while I'm here.
Wow, that's neat. I was looking when I was little that I know, and I realized, okay, there's North and South Korea, and there's a North and South of Vietnam. Is there any sort of connection, you know, with both places that's, you know, comparable with the politics or what happened with North, that North and South are divided?
Well, I can say for sure when Bill Clinton said that the joint security area, the JSA area between North and South Korea, is one of the scariest places that I've ever been.
Which place is this again?
The joint security area in South Korea.
In between?
Right, it's shared by South Korea and North Korea, it's literally like a conference room.
Hmm.
And I remember being there. I went on a tour, and, you know, the tour guides made sure to tell us, there are people from all over the world, Westerners from all over, a couple of Canadians, Australians, etc. Okay, so we're in the JSA area, the joint security area, where North and South Korea share a conference room. And the tour guide said, please make sure that you don't come within a foot of any of the soldiers.
Hmm.
And so one of the tourists who was there, unfortunately, he did not listen. He came too close, and the guard hit him across the room.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was just a really scary situation because the South Koreans and North Koreans were both on guard and alert. And it was it's very politicized, you know, not just for the global community, but for them. And so it was just a very dangerous situation that I felt I was in.
Hmm. Yeah, it reminded me of, I was in a museum in the city a couple years ago, and I was pointing at a painting, you know, and the guard woman came up to me because I guess my finger got a little too close. I didn't touch the painting at all, but it was just, I don't know, it's nothing near as dramatic as that, but it just reminded me of sometimes these sort of, you know, perils of going out places where this is sort of enhanced security. It's kind of strange sometimes.
It is.
So, yeah, anything else about the, you know, the North Korea, South Korea experience that you had?
Well, I think it was very interesting to be exposed to Asian culture. And, you know, East Asian culture generally the culture is very homogenous, and there's, unfortunately, there's still a lot of xenophobia. So being there as a woman and a black woman was definitely an interesting experience. I mean, I felt like many times I was being exoticized.
Exoticized?
Exoticized, like I was being looked at as if I was exotic.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was, I was trying to get that word. Huh. Yeah, I guess that's interesting. Huh. And that, was that, were people, was it like sort of just curiosity or more of like suspicion or sneering, or was there any other quality to it?
I think, you know, Mark, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was walking through Seoul and I was stopped to be photographed or put on a student's, you know, class video or something like that. So in many respects, I mean, that way it was positive, even though sometimes I felt like an object.
Right.
They just really wanted to learn more about me.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the subway, and at the time I had an afro, so I would,
right,
you know, you'd find the Korean woman wanted to touch my hair on the subway. So that was interesting too. But other times, you know, they have this saying in South Korea that black can rub off on you.
Oh my God.
So I, sometimes I'm, you know, walking, you know, through the subway, and, you know, people bump into each other, a city of 25 million people, that's bound to happen. And so it was just really bizarre, one time in particular, that this woman just, we bumped into each other and she started to brush off her sleeve.
Hmm.
So it really depended. Sometimes it was just really sort of cultural interest, and other times, you know, I think much of it was fear. Koreans are wonderful people, and
right,
I really enjoyed being there, but I think sometimes it was just fear of the unknown, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot, I guess, when, you know, just however one looks, whatever race or color or clothing, sometimes it stands out. I mean, in, you know, in New York City, people sort of don't notice anything because there's such homogenization. I mean, because there's such, you know, multicultural, but traveling to somewhere where there it's more homogenized, you know, it's just one of those things, I guess. But, you know, it sounds like you handled it quite bravely.
And you and I, we have that in common, actually, because I'm from New York City. I know that you're living or have been exposed to New York City, and I'm from New York City, so
it's
a very
neat,
many cultures.
You can walk down the streets of Manhattan in, you know, wearing whatever, ancient Egyptian garb or, you know, a Greek tunic or whatever, and people probably would barely look.
Exactly. So, very, very different environment where, and, you know, staring isn't, so I think for many times Westerners, you know, it's just a cultural difference, but staring, I think we think of as something that's, you know, quite rude.
Mm-hmm.
But in some other parts of the world, including East and Southern Asia, it's not really considered to be rude.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned, because you read your poem so well, you told me before we started the conversation that you just recently started a theater company. Can you mention that a little bit?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So I started a theater company. I'm actually the executive director for Performing Fusion Theater. And my partner is actually very well known in the Boston community for acting, Brian Moore Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And we started this theater company, and our mission is to pretty much integrate the Boston community, not just through the integration of art, but also really putting a different face to actors and actresses. And so it's very important for us as we move forward with our first event to make sure that our actors and actresses are from various cultural backgrounds and also represent different genders.
Excellent. That's nice to hear.
So our first event is going to be the Somerville Theater Festival.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to be on January 24th and January 25th. And at the moment, actually, we're looking for submissions for short plays, 10 minutes or less, and we're also looking for actors. So if anyone is interested in learning more about us, they can go to Facebook Performing Fusion Theater.
Okay, neat. Yeah, and you can send me the link, so I can put that up when the show is up on my website.
Okay, great.
Yeah, neat. So let's see, we're kind of, yeah, we're jumping around, which is fine. That's
we've done a lot of different topics. Yes.
Different things going. Yes, different conversations have a different flow.
Yes.
You mentioned Ho Chi Minh. Though I looked up briefly because I don't know that much, but Ho Chi Minh didn't actually commit suicide, did he?
No.
Okay. How did that get into the poem that way? It was like reflecting all the trauma that he had seen?
Actually, it's very interesting. I'm glad that you asked that question because I actually, when I was staying at that hostel, which really was like a penthouse, it was so, we were staying on the highest floor and we could see the lot, which is pretty much wine country. When the French colonized that area, there are plenty of vineyards. And so I was there with my girlfriends traveling, and one night I had the nightmare that Ho Chi Minh committed suicide. Mm. And, you know, sometimes dreams come through very fuzzy. When you wake up, you're not really sure what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is my way of sort of interpreting the dream, especially when I woke up and we ended up going for lunch, and the two Vietnamese children come up to us, who were obviously affected by Agent Orange. So it just really all came together, the dream with that incident. And that very evening, I was prompted to just sit in a coffee shop in the lot and write it out.
Hmm.
I had to.
Oh, yeah. That's the poetic license where, you know, you can say different things and, you know, it works. Because, like I said, I got the sense of that through the context of the poem. So I wasn't like, you know, I didn't look it up and I didn't think, oh, you know, what happened? Why did she write that? It was more like, oh, she's doing it for a reason.
Yes, and I think for me, the way that I sort of rationalize it is that, I mean, he had to grapple with that. I mean, he really was very proud as a Vietnamese. From what I know about him, he was very proud and he really wanted, you know, Vietnamese to be without sort of Western influence. And you know, they went to bat for that. So many Vietnamese died in the Vietnam War and leading up to the Vietnam War and still suffer from Agent Orange. And so I think, obviously, I never met Ho Chi Minh, but I would assume that in his mind, he sort of had to grapple with the death, the death toll of the children and the woman, because women were taking up arms as well. They weren't just sitting down. They were also fighting. And so that must have been difficult for him to know that he's leading his country to freedom, so to speak, but the sacrifice is huge.
Yeah. Now, is there any, like, not minimizing it, but aside from the sort of the toxic legacy, has the country, you know, has the people or the country in general itself sort of things gotten a lot better? I mean, I'd heard from someone who traveled a few years ago that, you know, it was like beautiful. The fields and things had been, you know, like a rebuilding, is that in certain sections?
It's, you know what, it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gorgeous place. The people are just beautiful, and not just physically, but if they can, they would just invite you into their homes. They're beautiful people, and the landscape is gorgeous, and there's been, you know, the United States has helped with this as well, including President Obama, but you know, there's been quite a bit of recovery money that's helped them to rebuild. Also, they really got into tourism, and which they should have, considering that it's such a beautiful place to be. And so tourism is really thriving in certain areas, particularly by the coast. So you could see them interacting with the tourists from all over the world and just really a beautiful cultural exchange as you travel the coast.
Oh yeah, it's good to hear. There's some balance now, as the people that, you know, they're still dealing with the, say, Agent Orange. Is there any kind of treatment for that, or is that like, you know, a lifelong thing, or are they able to live in some, you know, some kind of normal life, or is that, you know, how devastating is it?
You know, from what I know, I mean, depending if there's some sort of mental retardation, obviously that's a lot harder, but there are cosmetic options for people that are born with physical deformities, and you do still have quite a bit of children who are born with physical deformities, twisted arms and, you know, twisted limbs. Maybe their lip looks gnawed or something. But generally speaking, it doesn't seem as though, you know, the Vietnamese are really in the financial position to really take care of it, to take care of that physical deformity with, you know, cosmetic surgery. It's really interesting because even speaking to people with the physical deformities, it just they just don't have the chip on the shoulder that you would expect.
Yeah.
They were still very friendly and very open. And even when I thought about actually saying that I was Canadian, but, you know, I was like, maybe I should say I'm Canadian. I just feel a sense of guilt. But I fessed up to the fact that I was American and began to feel more comfortable saying that. And they welcomed me with open arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in their minds, it was a long time ago, and there's really no need to sort of hold on to that, to a grudge.
Yeah, that's heartwarming to hear in the, you know, humanitarian
So that was that was great to really experience that they still welcomed me and my other friends who were American with open arms.
That's very nice. Yeah, I mean, in the news nowadays, I sometimes make reference writing to like that. I mean, Agent Orange. I think Monsanto company. They're one of the corporations that were producing the Agent Orange back then, and now they're in the, you know, the food GMO food business. So just that, you know, that in itself raises a major warning flag as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people are concerned. Who knows, you know, what they're doing to the genetically modified foods. It's kind of strange. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I don't want to go off on a tangent there, because...
No, but I do see where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, it's like there's something, the historical dots that, you know, that sometimes they get lost in the current news, but, you know, one of the reasons history fascinates me is then, oh yeah, you know, look at this and then look at this and see if there's something to it. So...
Right, exactly. The amount of social, cultural variables.
Uh-huh, yeah. All right, Aisha, let's, how about we go to some of the poems from South that you wrote in South Korea. There was a couple that I would like you to read. One was about the cab driver with the cookie, and
the other cab driver with the cookie.
Yeah, why don't we start with that one?
That's a really interesting one too. I really feel like this manuscript is just full of a variety of little stories. But so this actually happened when I was in Seoul, and I went out that night and decided to take a cab. A night out passes into the early of day. I lie out in the back of the taxi, refusing to be eaten by all of the extra space. I doze off and awake to tell the driver, straighta, Juseo, naksungde. Through the mirror, he smiles at me. Ah, naksungde. Motioning forward, I don't see him break it into two. He hands me half a coconut cookie. 감사합니다. I bow and eat, and I wonder. This strange kindness, how could it leak at just the right time? And had a cookie ever made me cry harder?
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Besides, you know, being just a beautiful poem and the humanity and the word, the leak, how did it leak? Just the excellent use of the word leak there. And the cookie's great.
yes, the cookie's great. And just the kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Just the kindness of, you know, between two people who, this is when I first arrived in Seoul, who don't speak the same language.
Yeah, the humanity, those moments that, you know, people that travel tend to get those moments. But as a poet, to put that in the form is wonderful.
And just so able to communicate on some level, I just found really touching, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a poem in driving with a Pakistani cab driver, and it's a longer poem than that. But it was a similar kind of connection of, you know, just having this amazing conversation one time going to a poetry reading and, you know, driving with this Pakistani cab driver. Especially, it was a lot closer to after, you know, the 2011 stuff and September 2011 stuff. So that was part of my point in the poem. Same kind of thing of that connecting with someone and, And, you know, it happens sometimes when you don't expect it.
Well, I'd love to read it.
All right, I can. I'll send that. Also, the cookie I wanted you mentioned in your bio that you like baking. So I wondered. Oh, that was one of my sort of non sequitur questions I planned, was to ask you what kind of baking you like to do.
Oh wow! You know, the winters can be so tough in Boston. So I actually picked up this hobby last year. We had so many snowstorms, and I just wanted to keep myself busy. But I love making cupcakes, banana bread, banana pie, apple pie. I made a chocolate mousse today. So my range when it comes to making desserts is quite broad.
That's neat. Yeah, it's really an art or a creative outlet or whatever. I like doing a little bit minimal stuff, but after working or reading a lot all day, it's nice to get in the kitchen and sort of it's non-thinking in that typical sense of as a writer publisher.
It's very fun in that way, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. And you had another poem about the family, my family. I guess the people, is that people you were staying with in Korea?
Actually, when I was in Korea, I had a studio which had its pros and cons. It was nice to have a private space, but it also was lonely at times. But so this poem is from one of my lonely moments when I'm talking about my family back here in the States.
Okay.
Yes. So would you like me to read?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So this is from actually the first chapter of Black Hands of a Morning Calm.
Okay.
My family, they're like a photo printed on a sweater hanging to dry. They say my name. They ask questions about my new life. I say things in Hangugyeo. They laugh and clap. I tell them that I can write in Hangul. They laugh and clap. They ask me when. When are you coming home? Soon, soon, I say again. Can't you work in Boston? Oh, okay. Keep trying. I can smell their fart, but I can't smell the rain pouring outside my veranda. I can smell my mother's curry, but I can't smell the burning cigarettes I keep smoking in my room. And when the broadband fails, the screen goes black. And email is, friends want to hear my adventures, sitting in my little studio, at face the tops of trees, the peaks of Gwanaksan, picking dandruff, looking at unpacked luggage, saturating my ends with shea butter, writing a letter to a lover that stays in my head. Clichés don't matter outside of my country. I have no country. My country's too busy making graduates apply for food stamps. No, I'm busy looking up, leaving my body on the front line of the Korean War. Museum men of steel, men of valor, had a battle beyond me. No, I'm busy performing in expat plays. I'm a salesman with nothing to sell. I'm an alien who speaks gibberish. No, I'm busy listening to Dokkaebi folk tales, watching a woman play a flute like a flute, reading the English subtitles on a Korean film, having the fish doctors eat away at my dead skin, trying to keep my feet.
Wow, wonderful. Very, very nice. So many things going on that I like. It's too much for me to even stop and comment, but it made me think, what kind of poetry has influenced your writing? Because it has a kind of lyrical and beat kind of flowing feel to it, but yeah, you tell me.
Well, Yusuf Kamanyaka influenced my poetry.
He's awesome. Yeah.
He's amazing.
Amazing guy.
He's amazing, and just his work, you know, and his poetry about Vietnam when he was there as an American news correspondent has really touched me. Also, June Jordan, Claudia Rankin, Elizabeth Alexander, and her work is also quite lyrical, and it also deals with social issues, such as the historical representation of the Black female body. And so I think in particular, those poets have really influenced my work. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, my background is in sociology, so I can also point to critical theorists such as, you know, Bell Hooks and Feminism is for Everybody has also influenced my work.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. I wanted to ask, I wanted to run this joke I have among fellow poets, since you'll appreciate it, I hope. But it sort of leads into a genuine question. I mean, it's kind of sad that there's these months that we give to people, like maybe it's Native American Heritage Month or something. But my sort of joke is that the February is African American or African History Month. And then March, I think, is Women's Month, and April is Poetry Month. So
yes.
It's kind of my joke is that, hey, black female poets have it, you know, really good, because they get 3 months. They get 3 months to do stuff, you know, so. But
I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm glad you're laughing.
I think that's awesome.
but for real, though, you know, what is it, you know, for you as a, you know, as a, not, I don't like labels, but, you know, as a black female poet, how does that, do you find that, you know, what's your experience of that? Does it help, or does you find it has hurdles, or, you know, I guess it could be like anybody of any nationality has their own things to deal with, but.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that's the point, that everyone from different cultural backgrounds, nationalities, have their sort of own isms to deal with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I always rely on Nelson Mandela has said this, and also Martin Luther King Jr., that discrimination anywhere is discrimination everywhere.
Mm.
And so I come from a real humanist perspective on that, and so I believe in inclusiveness,
mm-hmm.
really. And so, for example, even though I'm not gay, I'm a huge advocate for gay rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think any opportunity that we have to celebrate ourselves and to connect with one another, with one another, and to really, you know, take time to invest and share history is really important. So I do, even though it's just 1 month, and Black History may be the shortest month, it's still a month.
Right.
It's still a month, and it's still a great opportunity to, you know, for me as a Black woman to learn more about Black history, but more broadly, speaking more broadly, it's a great opportunity for everyone to learn more about Black history, because that is our history,
mm-hmm.
as Americans,
right.
And the same thing for Women's Month, and the same thing for Poetry Month, and every other opportunity that we have to celebrate ourselves and the beauty of diversity in our culture.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. I know the Lakota, in the Lakota language, they're big inclusive, they don't even have a word for exclusive. It's like they just, you know, they grow up thinking inclusive. You know, and you know, if something you don't like, you find a way to work with it,
right?
Because there's just no such thing as like excluding. So it's a quite a cultural thing. It seems like more people, I don't know, more people at least that I talk to in their 20s or 30s are seems to be like it's in that, you know, hope for humanity category, that people are becoming more open minded and more accepting of people of all different, you know, ways of lifestyle. So it's refreshing to hear you mention it as well.
Yes, I agree with you. I think we are coming along to being more open to different people's lifestyles.
What is a social scientist? Because that's in your bio as well. And I mean, I sort of know what that means, but what can you say a little bit about, you know, how the social sciences, how that relates to this kind of, you know, discussion?
Right. Well, I've always been very interested in, you know, studying sociology and doing research, just really taking a look at how we live, and not on a, you know, psychological level, but really sort of looking at themes and trends,
mm-hmm.
within groups and cultures. And it's very interesting to me, just because, you know, there have been so many atrocities in our history. And I think that many different people of different nationalities could say that, right?
Right.
So for me, you know, looking at that really helps me to sort of figure out, you know, how can we learn from atrocities, and how can we make this world a better place for us all to live in? And a part of that is really just sort of understanding,
mm-hmm.
on a cultural and social level, why we do certain things that we do, why we have particular values, how can we change those values into values that are more inclusive And so I started with sociology years ago, but I realized that I just felt really, in many ways, the discipline is so confined. And I thought, well, you can take elements of sociology and really incorporate them in creative ways. And so I think that's what I've done with Black Hands of a Morning Calm. I'm making lots of commentary on race and gender and culture in a creative way.
That's wonderful. Now, that book you said is coming out towards the end of the year?
Yes, we should have it before Christmas.
Oh, neat. Oh, that's wonderful. Is that your first full publication?
Yes, it is. Wow. I've published poems and critical essays, but this is going to be my first book, so I'm very excited.
Wow, that's wonderful. Congratulations to you.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe we're kind of winding it up here. Anything else you want to add?
I think really just to say to writers and whoever else will be listening in is that I think that it's really crucial that we develop a global perspective on how we look at each other. And so traveling is really crucial, and I'm going to continue to do it. And I just really just want to urge everyone to travel. I just think it really changes you. And, you know, Sylvia Plath and several other writers have said this, but if you don't travel, if you don't live, then what are you going to write about?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just really an important philosophy to me.
I think it is. It's important to, whether the travel is long distance or even local or, you know, just sometimes cultural centers in a town, a movie theater or someplace where, you know, it's connecting with people of, you know, different cultures, like you said, especially as an artist, it opens up different venues and forms of expression.
Yes, I agree, Mark, even if it's on a very micro level, like going to the next community or just of, broadening your friendships and, becoming friends with people from different backgrounds. I think it all is helpful. And I just really want to thank you so much for this interview. It was really lovely to speak with you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's delightful. You're delightful to speak to. And, you know, I really enjoy hearing, about your travels and all your different adventures and, anything else, is a new poem or anything else you could pick to finish up with?
Well,
wait, that's a question poets love to hear, right? You want me to read something?
Yes, what do you want me to read something? Oh, well, I do have, I think it would be kind of cool to read the first short poem from Black Hands of a Morning Calm.
Oh, excellent.
I think it sort of points to, not just about my time in Seoul, but I think in many ways we can all identify with just how the metropolis can be sort of overwhelming and how do you navigate that.
Okay.
12 million people brisk by in the streets, in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, on a Sunday when everywhere is a downtown, luminous lights line the streets and towers. After the day, during the day, please, please let me lie in black.
Very nice. Wow, thank you so much. It's very inspiring, and you made me want to like go out and hop in a cab or something to try to write another poem again.
I know. I feel like coming down towards your way, coming down to New York.
So if you get this way, let me know. I had asked you what kind of music you like to try to figure out, you know, what kind of music to play as the outro, and you had mentioned reggae and folk and maybe blue, you know, jazz or whatever. But anyway, I just web searched reggae and folk and saw this. First thing that came up was a song by Richie Ramsey, who I hadn't heard of, called Mother Earth's Cry, and it's a beautiful song, so I'm gonna play that. And thank you very much, Aisha, and I wish you well with all you're doing.
Thank you, Mike. It was great to have this opportunity to speak with you.
All right. You're welcome. Take care.
Take care.
When you turn on your light, do you think you'll pay the real price? You're always complaining that your light bill's too high, but do you know how than oil, and still you do not see the light. So now you turn on your pipe, see the water feels just right.
Strife.